You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's hard to pigeonhole Nicole Krause's novel, The History of Love, because it's tender, sad, really funny, and in a way, it's at least three novels interwoven into one book. It's a kind of a novel that you find yourself rushing through because you want to find out what happens, all the while wanting to go slower because you relish the writing. When it first came out, it got the most amazing and well-deserved reviews, and I'm very pleased that there's a new paperback edition from Norton, which has finally given me the chance to speak with Nicole Krause about the book on the air. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
How are you again?
Good.
This book has such a complicated structure. Did you have it all in mind from the beginning? Did you know what you were doing, getting yourself into when you started?
Not at all. And I think if I had known, I probably wouldn't have started this novel because it was really, I was pulling my hair out a lot of the time that I was writing this book because I felt as if I were sort of walking backwards and never knowing what I was going to step into. I simply started with the sound of a voice of an old man named Leo Gursky. And once I was writing in that voice for a while, I somehow wanted a counterpoint to it, something somehow at the other end of the spectrum of life. So I began to write in the voice of this young girl named Alma Singer. And then for a very long time, I would say a year of writing this book, I was simply trying to figure out how these two voices belonged in the same story.
Did it feel strange to move back and forth between Leo and Alma?
In a way, it was a relief. I think the thing one wants to avoid as a novelist is boredom. And after a while of spending time in the head of a man who was literally at the edge of life, staring down into the abyss of death, one gets a little either depressed or even, I say, bored. And so to be able to switch to this young voice full of life and all of its own sadnesses and wonders was kind of a relief.
So it's almost like playing in a repertory company where one night you're playing an 80-year-old man and the next night you're playing a 14-year-old girl.
It was.
Although you have another character here as well.
Yeah, and that character is almost the character of a book, a lost manuscript that goes from Poland to South America to United States, all the while changing hands and sort of slowly bringing all of these far-flung stories together.
But all of those characters have something in common, even though they're different. They're survivors.
They are. I think in a certain way they've all lost something and are trying to deal with that loss. And I think most of them turn to the imagination somehow in order to deal with their grief. They somehow use acts of invention in order to make life bearable.
Well, your first novel was all about loss. Is this a logical follow-up to Man Walks Into a Room? In that case, where a brain tumor erased an English professor's memory?
Yeah, I think both books, in a way, are sort of reapproaching the idea of memory and trying to somehow overthrow the burden of memory. None of the characters want to be held down or sort of drowned in their grief. They're all looking for ways to kind of find new ways of being present in their lives.
How much of this was inspired by your grandparents? You've dedicated the book to them, and you say that they taught you the opposite of disappearing, although I'm not sure I understand what that means.
Well, my grandparents all were Jewish and all came from different places in Europe. There's a moment in the book where Leo Gursky has just basically survived the war, comes to America, and he goes to get his photograph taken, and he doesn't show up in the photograph. And so he becomes obsessed with this because, of course, he had to hide during the war. So he had to become invisible for the entirety of that time. And he keeps going to these photographic booths, and he doesn't show up, And one day he moves, and a kind of little blur shows up on the paper. And he says it was the opposite of disappearing. My grandparents all, you know, they all survived. They all had to leave Europe because of the war. But in a way, that was never really part of the conversation that I had with them.
They didn't talk about their memories?
Very little. I think they, and because of that, they really always were sort of teaching me about how to be alive now, sort of not how not to let the past kind of sit achingly on one's shoulders.
And Leo Gursky is really worried about disappearing. He says, I often wonder who'll be the last person to see me alive. If I had to bet, I'd been on the delivery boy from the Chinese takeout, and then he does all of these, he develops all these strategies for getting noticed so that people would know that he was alive.
Yeah, I started to write his voice just at the moment when my first book was published, and I think I had a lot of questions in my mind about what it meant to be seen. To be a published writer is to be seen in a way that is very strange.
You mean you'd pretty much lived in a room alone, working away at a novel for years, and now suddenly you're out in public talking about yourself in a way that you'd never had to before.
And though that was the hope the whole time, there's a way in which I found it somehow a little bit melancholy. I worried a little bit that I'd taken this thing that I loved my whole life, writing, and somehow turning it into a profession was going to poison it in some way. Who was I writing for, and would I be writing for certain people to please them or not? And so to embody the voice of this character who really was invisible and who his whole life was a writer but who believed he'd never been read, that his work had never had any effect on anybody, somehow strangely was a kind of weirdly hopeful position to write out of.
His book was The History of Love, and part of the story is how this book made it to the United States, how it disappeared and how it is rediscovered and how it's translated. And that winds up tying all of the different stories together. Now, your first novel was about one character, pretty much. Here you have all these different strands. Is one of the reasons you write, you said, obviously, to get recognition, be affirmed, but also one of the reasons you write to challenge yourself, to do more and more difficult things?
Yeah, I think in a way, writing for me is always a process of discovery, and in that discovery, it's kind of a finding of my freedom. And the first book was I had been writing poetry when I was a teenager in my early 20s, and somehow breaking into this new form where suddenly everything seemed possible again was so exciting for me. And I hardly even thought about what kind of form that novel would take, because it was just being in the novel, which was so new. But then by the time it came time to write a second novel, I had thought a lot about how to sort of break open that freedom even more, how to kind of find my liberation in it.
So how different is working on a poem? I mean, there are long poems. You can write book-length poems, and writing a novel in prose.
Well, I think a poem always has the capacity for perfection in a way that a novel simply doesn't. I mean, I'm addicted to reading novels, but I've never read one that's perfect. And somehow setting out knowing that the form is inherently flawed is a huge relief to me.
And why is it inherently flawed?
Well, I think it's a form that is always trying to reinvent itself. It's never happy with what it is. And I think each time we sit down to write a novel, we're also trying to answer the question, what is this thing? I remember there was this moment when I was at the very beginning of The History of Love, when I read a book by David Grossman called Sea Under Love. And it just blew my mind.
Great Israeli writer.
And I think a masterpiece of a novel, even though it is flawed in so many ways. But it's a novel that attempts to do everything, that believes that everything is possible in the space between these two covers, beginning and end. And that was incredibly inspiring to me.
My guest is Nicole Krauss, whose novel, The History of Love, has just been issued in paperback by W.W. Norton after having had a very nice life as a hardcover book. Would you read something for us?
Sure. Why don't I just read from the very beginning, the first page, which is in Leo's voice. When they write my obituary, tomorrow or the next day, it will say Leo Gursky is survived by an apartment full of... I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this word on the air.
Well,
so I'll skip
don't.
It. I'm surprised I haven't been buried alive. The place isn't big. I have to struggle to keep a path clear between bed and toilet, toilet and kitchen table and front door. If I want to get from the toilet to the front door, impossible. I have to go by way of the kitchen table. I like to imagine the bed as home plate, the toilet as first, the kitchen table is second, the front door is third. Should the doorbell ring while I am lying in bed, I have to round the toilet and the kitchen table in order to arrive at the door. If it happens to be Bruno, I let him in without a word, and then jog back to bed, the roar of the invisible crowd ringing in my ears.
Nicole Krauss reading from The History of Love, her second novel, a book that has books within it. We mentioned that The History of Love is Leo Gursky's novel, but he's also written another book called Words for Everything. And despite everybody being so articulate in this novel, the characters seem to have tremendous difficulty communicating with each other. And then life intervenes and makes it even more difficult. Do you feel that words can communicate the most complicated aspects of life?
I don't, and I think that if they could, I'd probably be out of a job.
So this is the struggle to try to capture things, and you could just as easily have written it differently to find the same answers, if there are answers?
I think so. I mean, I think, well, first of all, one writes novels to ask questions, and rarely does one sort of write out or find the answers. The questions are the important part. But I think the labor of making oneself understood is something that somehow all of my characters seem burdened by. And, of course, Leo can call a book that because he knows words for everything is something that doesn't exist. Somehow, if language were perfect, communication would be simple and straightforward, and there'd be no need for literature.
You've said that it makes you kind of sad that when writers get together, they tend not to talk about the great issues of the day, literary and philosophical and the like, but rather, who's your publisher? Did you see that awful review that someone you know got?
When did I say that? I don't know. I guess I'm a real homebody, I have to say. And I think it's important as a writer, particularly a writer living in New York City, to somehow close her ears and put blinders on to what's going on around you. When I wrote my first book, I was very aware of what other American novelists sounded like. And in the years since then, I've sort of become less and less aware of that. A lot of the books I read, most of the books I read, are published by New Directions and are by foreign writers. So I'm always sort of, I'd rather have my ear on what's happening far away than what's happening in the literary world right around me.
But does it matter whether they're foreign writers or American writers? For example, you say that you had an epiphany when you were assigned to read 100 Years of Solitude at school, but you've often cited Philip Roth as an influence, James Salter as an influence. Those are wonderful American writers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're American writers that I love, and when you love a writer, I think they leave their mark on you and on your work. Saul Bellow was another writer who I always sort of return to. But I think more and more the writers that excite me and who give me that kind of revelation, which I think becomes rarer and rarer as you get older as a reader and you've read more books. It's like you need, you know, if you're addicted and you need your fix, it gets harder and harder to get. They seem to be writers who come from elsewhere. Somehow
like?
This Roberto Bolaño, the Chilean writer, is a kind of somewhat recent discovery for me. And I think I've read By Night in Chile and Distant Star each three times since I read them for the first time.
Do you learn something from reading them three times?
Of course. I mean, I don't read to learn in a way. I mean, but I think they must somehow sift into some part of me that ultimately does come out in the work. But I guess I don't look for familiarity. I know what I know. In a way, I read to look for, to arrive at someplace new and foreign.
Are you surprised that Americans don't know more about the great literature of Latin America, for example? Machado de Assis, considered by many the greatest writer that the Americas ever produced. I doubt that most people here have even heard his name.
I guess what surprises me is that if you look on the cover of a book and it says translated by, apparently that book sells far fewer copies than a book also in translation that is not marked on the front cover with that. So I remember speaking once to somebody at New Directions who was telling me they began to publish the writer W.G. Sebald, and then later he went over to a much larger publishing house. And when that publishing house published the book without advertising it as a translation, of course, it, you know, sort of, I don't know, made the independent bestseller list at least. So I think that it's sort of strange that we don't have, in the States, we don't have as much of a desire in our literary taste to find out what's happening elsewhere.
Of course, this book includes a translation, which we get as it's being translated. If I remember correctly, The History of Love was in development to become a film directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who directed Y Tu Mama También. Is that, and also one of the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
Is that still happening?
It is. And in fact, there's a kind of wonderful ironic story attached, which is that Alfonso asked a Mexican playwright to do the adaptation, and she wrote it in Spanish. And it's now waiting, or I believe it has been now, translated into English. And in fact, The History of Love, the novel within my novel, goes through a very similar sort of journey, translated from Yiddish into Spanish and then finally into English. So the film is somehow shadowing the life of the novel.
Nicole Krause's The History of Love is now available in paperback from Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. ¶¶